The 12th of Elul is Lili Nishmas Sipora Fega Bas Rav Yaakov. Irene Katz, Allah Shalom, contributed by the Katz family. So all of the Torah today should be Lili Nishmasa. Today is also, is that right? I'm a little disconnected from the English calendar, but it's September 11th today, is that correct? Right. So at least as a Yom Chol, it's a very, very significant day. 10 years ago, this great tragedy did happen, which in many ways changed the world. Of course, in many ways, what September 11th taught is that what Yidden go through in Eretz Yisrael, year after year after year, can now spread to the rest of the world as well, and nobody's really safe. Really, it's a very good argument for moving to Israel, because people always say, oh, I can't move to Israel because it's so dangerous. HaKadosh Baruch Hu shows you there's no safety anywhere else either. You might as well be here. You know, it's kind of a good argument that takes away the arguments against coming to Eretz Yisrael. But that's right. Now we're all Israelis, like John F. Kennedy said, now we're all Berliners, right, we're all Israelis. And now, but the truth of the matter is that one of the lessons we see in September 11th is an interesting lesson. And David HaMelech says, there's a pasuk in Tehillim, Mi oyevai tachkimeni. And the standard English translation means, make me wiser than my enemies. That's how it's the English. But Chazal have a drasha, make me wise from my enemies. Meaning to say, we can sometimes look at the Rishoyim of the world, and we can actually learn things to emulate, in a sense, from a Russia. How do you emulate from a Russia? You're not supposed to emulate a Russia, you reject a Russia. Here's the thing. A person lives in the world, and a person sees all sorts of things that need to be done. But a person says, who am I? I'm just one person. I'm powerless. I'm ineffectual. I don't have the ability to create goodness in the world. Look at Rishonim of the world. Look at the small number of people who are able to wreak such havoc and such destruction. In other words, you can learn Hitler, whatever it is. You can look at the fact, you can look at a Russia and you can see, in a dark negative way, the power of the individual. And if the individual has power to do such evil, Kal v'chomer Hashem gave us power to do good. So from looking at the havoc and the destruction that even a small number of Rishayim can do, we can look at ourselves and say, you know, I can generate light, I can generate goodness, I can make things happen in a positive way to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. And a person should never say, who am I? I'm a nothing. Because those people who hijacked those three planes had nothing but box cutters and, you know, scissors, basically. And they were able to do what they were able to do. So that is what David HaMelech says when he says, Mi oyvai tachkimeni. Sometimes we learn from the enemies of Hashem how we have to be committed to what we have to do in life. In other words, so that's one of the things that we can think about. I was just asked, just very quickly, just to review, just the list. Remember, we were looking at Hilchos Teshuva, and that's what we're doing. And I'll go over very quickly. The Rambam at the end of Perek Aleph Mehilchos Teshuva essentially quotes a brisa from Maseches Yuma that divides all Averos into four categories. I'll just go over it very quickly again. Starting from the least severe, which we'll call Category 1, to the most severe, which we'll call Category 4. So the Rambam says Category 1 sin is simply not doing a mitzvah taseh. The Torah says to do something and you don't do it. It's a sin of omission. So b'chi ha'gavna, all you need is tshuva, and God forgives the avera. Even before Yom Kippur, Hashem forgives with tshuva. Category 2 is more chamor. This is a lo sase. For example, kashrus. The Torah says don't eat chazir. If chas v'shalom, a person ate chazir, so even with tshuva, that's not enough. You also need the cleansing koach of Yom Kippur. So in the language of the Rambam, tshuva is tola. Tshuva gives you a suspended atonement, But there is no final atonement till the fast of Yom Kippur. Then we have a category 3 Aveira, which is not only a negative commandment, but it's a negative commandment for which the punishment, Bizman HaMikdash, is a Chiyuv Misa, that would include desecrating Shabbos and the like. So here you need 3 steps for Kapara. You need Tshuva, you need Yom Kippur, and you need a certain measure of suffering in life, which are called Yesurin. Now Yesurin can be the worst type of Yesurin, illness and the like, or it can even be a minor thing. I miss my bus, or I lost some change. That's, you pray to Hashem that the Yesurin should be Mekel, but whatever form, Yesurin are a Kapara, but not alone. Yesurin are a Kapara together with Yom Kippur and Tshuva. The fourth level, category 4, is the worst of all Averos, and this is the Avera of Chilul Hashem, and that means any behavior which causes other people, Jews or Goyim, to look at the Torah and the Jewish people as corrupt and immoral and bad and inconsiderate, even. And Chilul Hashem, Tshuva does not do it alone. Yesurin does not do it alone. Yom Kippur does not do it alone. There is literally no kapara till death. Now that does mean by the time a person dies, hopefully if he has the other stages, he'll go to Olam Haba. But in his life, there'll always be some distance between himself and God. That's a very scary and disheartening thought. I did mention, just by way of quick review, Rabbeinu Yonah in Shaarei Tshuva does qualify the Rambam statements by suggesting that even for Chilul Hashem, there are 2 avenues of kapara, even when you're alive. One is to dedicate your life to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. It's kind of, if you created a certain Chilul Hashem, you go out of your way to create Kiddush Hashem. Now, granted, that's not a complete fix, because often the Chilul Hashem you created there is not necessarily to the same people of the Kiddush Hashem you're creating here, but at least in a cosmic sense, there's a certain redressing of the balance. And the other Eitzah that the Rabbeinu Yonah mentions, and this might only apply to men, it's not entirely clear, is to study Torah, Talmud Torah, with extreme devotion and sacrifice. And he ingeniously says, this is because Chazal themselves have a drasha, that when one studies Torah with great sacrifice, that is considered to be a form of death. He's memis atzma ala Torah. Ah, so it's wonderful. Chilul Hashem gets a kapara with death, but you kill yourself in your learning, that's considered to be a form of misa. And Rabbeinu Yonah's proof that these are the 2 methods that are a kapara even for Chilul Hashem is because the B'nai Eli, who were guilty of Chilul Hashem, because they abused their position as Kohanim, they were guilty of desecrating God. So the pasuk says, "Bechesed uviyames yechupar avon." Their sin shall be atoned with chesed, loving kindness, which is really Kiddush Hashem, and emes, the truth, is of course limud haTorah. Chesed viyames yechupar avon. That's even Chilul Hashem. The Gemara says, just to indicate this, the Gemara says that the psukim in Shmuel indicate that Eli's family was under an eternal curse, that they would all die young, relatively young. They would die when their hair was still dark, as it were. And the Gemara tells us 2 great rabbis, 2 of the greatest rabbis of the Gemara, were descended from Eli. It was Abaya and Rabbah. And it mentions that the one that was Oseg primarily in Torah, but not so much chesed, died at the age of 40. The one that was Osek in Torah and chesed lived until the age of 60. And that's b'chesed. Also not that old, but still, b'chesed v'yemes, yechup ha'ravam. Right? Yeah.
Is tzedakah considered part of tshuva?
Tzedakah is not a part of tshuva, but it all depends. I mean, technically, it's interesting. The Rambam does not mention tzedakah as a separate mechaper. The Rambam only mentions tshuva
In fact, he doesn't even mention tefillah. The Rambam mentions tshuva, yisurin, yom kippur, and misa as the four mechaprim. Now, where it comes to, so what does it mean when we say tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah? Mavirin. Excuse me, mavirin, esrela, hagzera. So here, Rabbeinu Yonah has an interesting classification. Rabbeinu Yonah says that there are certain things that are called darchei tshuva, meaning certain behaviors that lead you on the way to experience genuine tshuva. And tzedakah is considered to be one of the darchei hatshuva. So tzedakah, according to this reading, is not a direct mechaper. But the giving of the tzedakah brings you closer to Hashem, so you become more inspired to do tshuva. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said you do what the doctors say.
Yeah, sure.
That I should try to give tzedakah and do chesed, even personal chesed, as I don't have the
tone. Yes. Well, that's very true. In other words, the one thing is very clear that even if tzedakah is not tshuva, but tzedakah does have a substitute for a fast. That's already brought down in many, many sources. For example, the Kisvei Arizal, which we don't follow today because we're a weak generation, actually has a catalog of how many fasts you do for all sorts of averus. Besides the, in other words, there's a whole catalog. There's a whole catalog. For certain averus, you actually do 84 fasts. You know, it's very, you know, so the Baal HaTanya writes in one of his letters that Bizman HaZeh, and this was already 250 years ago, Bizman HaZeh, we are a weaker generation. So we do not do these extra fast days, but we should make up for them by giving tzedakah. So the notion that tzedakah is b'makom tanis is that's a well-established idea. Yeah. Now that's referring to the optional fast, but certainly if medically a person is not allowed to fast even on Yom Kippur, so tzedakah would make perfect sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
Make of it when people under duress of persecution may be wavered and didn't necessarily let themselves be murdered. And he wrote a letter, so he was really make of about maybe human weak, whatever you want to call it. So.
Well, yeah, the Rambam was dealing the Rambam was dealing with an actual situation in Yemen. The Rambam lived in Egypt, but in Yemen there were Islamic persecutions in which Jews were basically told, you have to say whatever they say, you know, Muhammad is God's prophet, or we're going to slit your throat. Now, the halacha would normally be that a Jew is obligated to give up their life before they renounce their Judaism and the like. So there was a chiyuv of mesiras nefesh, but many Jews were not able to do it for whatever reason. So they were told by a rabbi in Yemen, listen to this, they were told by a rabbi in Yemen, they are no longer Jewish. And God does not want their mitzvos. And their mitzvos are a blasphemy to the Almighty because they rejected God and they are outside of Am Yisrael. This is what a rabbi in Yemen told them. So the people were heartbroken because they wanted to keep on mitzvos. So they sent a question to the Rambam. Mm-hmm. What's the din? And the Rambam, you can read from the words that the Rambam was exploding in anger. That the Rambam sent a letter, the first five pages of the letter, he's talking about how evil this rabbi is, that he is, you know, degrading Am Yisrael, and how even Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't enter Eretz Yisrael when he said bad things about Am Yisrael, and Eliyahu HaNavi was fired and replaced by Elisha when he called the Jewish people rebellious. And the Rambam went on and on and on and on about what an evil thing it is. And what the Rambam articulated is an extremely important idea. Exactly what you said. The Rambam says, even when the halacha requires that you give your life, if out of fear of death you were not able to rise to that occasion, you're still a Jew in good standing. And whatever mitzvos you're able to do, you have to do. If you do it privately, secretly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will treasure your mitzvahs. And a Jew should never say, if I can't do everything, then I'm not Jewish anymore. And the Rambam gave tremendous comfort to that community. Now, he did say, if you can get out of there, gotta move. He says, you're not allowed to stay in a place where you can't keep the Torah. But he says, if you're stuck there and you can't leave, you should know that every mitzvah you do is cherished by the Almighty. This is Igeres Teman, a famous, very famous letter. And in fact, interestingly enough, the Temani Jews were so grateful to the Rambam that they added him to the Kaddish. When it says, you know, in those, may the Geula come, b'chayechon, in your lifetime, and they put, u'b'chayeh derabbana Moshe ben Maimon. And may the Mashiach come. I don't know, I guess it dropped out when the Rambam was nifter. But in, as long, from the time of that letter till the Rambam's Patira, the prayer for Mashiach was always added with the Rambam's name, that may the Mashiach come in his lifetime. So that was really a very, very important letter that gave people nechama and gave people comfort. And b'chlal, this is a very important idea. I'll give you other examples. Let's say, God forbid, somebody intermarries. Jew marries a guy. Very bad thing. But you know, he can still make Kiddush, still light Shabbos candles. In other words, what's the point? The point is, you're doing one Aveira, therefore, keep on doing all Aveiras? Whatever mitzvah you do, counts. They tell the story about the Vilna Gaon, that there was a time in the Vilna Gaon's life when he was wandering. He went into Golus. This was a minhag of certain tzaddikim, that they would actually travel anonymously through different cities, and they felt it was a form of exile, and exile is a kapara. So the Vilna Gaon was like wandering around, and he got arrested a few times. You know, in Europe in those days, you had to have all sorts of identity papers. You didn't have the papers. You know, it's not. See, in America, we're used to just, you know, you can go anywhere you want, but you know, then every city, you know, you had to have some type of identification. So he was thrown into prison, and his fellow prisoner was a Jew who was convicted of murder, which is pretty rare. Jews sometimes do white collar crimes, tax evasion or whatever it is, but you know, you don't have too many Jewish murderers. Anyway, they were eating bread, and the Vilna Gaon noticed that the person was not washing his hands before bread. So he says to the person, "Hey, you gotta wash your hands before you eat bread." So the person started laughing. He says, "These hands." You know, and the guy confessed to him, "These hands choke people. These hands murder people. You're telling me I got to do the Tila Shadayim?" And the Vilna Gaon says, "What does one thing have to do with the other?" He says, "Hey, right, Seyach, for sure, you're going to get punished. Still got to wash your hands. Still a mitzvah. You don't have the attitude, because I'm a murderer, I don't have to daven every day." You know, the Vilna Gaon was saying, every mitzvah is a separate thing, right? So just because you can't do, just because you're not doing something, doesn't mean you don't do anything. So even with intermarried couples, whatever it is, I mean, you know, if they can, I mean, the Jewish person, of course, if the Jewish one, you know, lights candles, says Kiddush, it's still a mitzvah, even if it's in the context of a relationship that is not a proper thing. Yeah.
Being sick, is that because you live on?
Well, it's simple to say. It's certainly not inevitably the case. Sometimes a person is sick. Number one, because they may have been careless. The Gemara actually says there are two Mamari Chazal. One is, everything is in the hands of heaven except fear of God. The other Maimar Chazal is, everything is in the hand of heaven except colds and fevers. Which means to say, sometimes, literally, we have spoken, even if you're the biggest tzaddik in the world, if you walk through puddles in a winter wind without wearing a coat, you might get sick. That's the teva. Sometimes sickness comes because a person is very righteous and his tribulations are a kapara for other people, right? Sometimes sickness is a punishment for an aveira. Sometimes sickness is an alarm to do tshuva. So what I'm saying is there are many, many, many reasons, and one cannot just automatically assume there's one reason why people do get sick. And of course, keep in mind that, you know, Let's take an illness like AIDS. Now, AIDS can come for different reasons, but certainly some of the reasons people get AIDS involve immoral behavior. Intravenous, drug use, or homosexual relations. Now, there are people who get AIDS from transfusions. We'll call them the innocent victims. But there are people who get AIDS because they do things that are aveiros. So the question becomes this, just as a general question. There are some Christian fundamentalists who basically say, hey, a guy gets sick because he does sins, why should we help him at all? So it's important to know that Halacha rejects that idea. Halacha says, chas v'shalom, even if a person gets a sickness because of an aveira, there is still a chiv to try to be metapel with him and to try to heal him. Of course, the extreme example, which is not so clear that that's a halachically valid, is that the people who blow up buses and go to Hadassah Hospital are treated along with the people they blowed up. You know, okay, now that's already a different shaila, but that's kind of an extreme manifestation of this idea that we take care of the sick even if their own averus caused the situation. Yeah.
You see in the Indian Malacca when the people were not keeping the Torah, you find Hashem didn't want it. Lama Lisa brought the Tzibchechem on Hashem.
Yeah. So here's a very interesting... Yeah. So here's an interesting point. So you're raising the question, if a person is a sinner who rebels against God, does God want any mitzvahs from that person? So the pasuk that was cited is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Lama li rov zivchechem, who wants your karbanos? Implying if you're a sinner, don't worship me. So here I want to say the following. It's a very good question. The concept that Hashem says through the Nevi'im, if you're a sinner, I don't want your avoda, you only find by karbanos. You don't find Hashem ever saying, why are you keeping kosher? You're immoral. Now, the reason is the following. Because the whole idea of a korban, what's a korban? Now, you have to remember, there was a difference in the way the pagan world viewed korbanos and the way we view korbanos. The pagan world also had korbanos. They had human korbanos as well as animal korbanos. But the pagan world viewed korbanos as a bribe, or sacrifices as a bribe. In other words, you have all of these different gods, and you give them food, or give them your children, give them whatever, and you bribe them, and then you get a free pass to do whatever you want to do. There was no concern with morality, per se. The ancient religions, let's say Greek, the gods didn't care. The gods themselves were mushchasim. I mean, based on their stories. You know, they were mizana, and they murdered, etc. The idea, see, it's so obvious to us that religion is connected to morality that we don't realize that that was not a connection that existed before Matan Torah. Because the pagan religions did not care about moral behavior. It was just a question of bribing the gods to get rishus to do whatever you wanted to do. Now, a korban is exactly the opposite. We bring a korban to be mashpil ourselves, to come to God in submission. Remember the Ramban explains, korbanos, is that we recognize that our life comes from Hashem and whatever is happening to the animals should happen to us. And the reason Hashem accepts a korban is not because he wants meat or likes the smell of meat, but rather by recognizing that I am an Eved Hashem, that brings nachas ruach to Hashem. So what the Nevi'im are saying is the following. If you bring a korban and then you go out and you rebel against God, what you're really saying is the korban is just a bribe. So Hashem says, not only are you a sinner, but the korban itself is offensive. The korban itself is mavazami, because you're implying you can buy Hashem off. So that's why you find it's only by korbanos that we say, in fact, there's a pasuk in Mishlei, Zevach Rishayim Te'eva. The korban of a Rasha is a Te'eva. Because if you bring a korban but you don't change your life, then you're looking at the korban like a bribe. The korban becomes an aveira. But you're not going to find in the Nevi'im, who needs your, in fact, even when it says, Chadshechem O Adechem, son of Nafshi, but that's going on the korban. That's going on the korban. I understand. That doesn't mean Hashem is saying, I hate the chag. He's saying, I hate the korban that you bring on the chag. That's the context. On Yom Tov, etc. So it's a very good point that the Reform movement actually likes to use, and the Reform movement used to call itself, I don't know if they use the name anymore, that they are prophetic religion. Because their point was, the five books of Moses has all sorts of rituals you got to do. But the prophets say, who needs rituals? The main thing is social justice, be fair, be kind. This is the message of the prophets, where Yeshayahu says, who needs your korbanos? Who needs all of it? So the Reform movement likes to call themselves the prophetic religion, because they connect to the prophets instead of the priestly religion that tries to make all these rules. But the truth of the matter is, if you look in the Nevi'im, Yirmiyahu has many nevuas about Shabbos, keeping Shabbos, and not tarrying. and about keeping kosher. I mean, the Nevi'im certainly do talk a lot about social justice, no question, but they talk about ritual things too. So it's only if the Nevi'im were against rituals, they were against, we could say, korbanos, which are brought by insincere people who are not changing their life because of the korban. That becomes hypocrisy. But they were not against, they did not say, for example, oh, you're intermarried, why wear tefillin? You know, you're not going to find that type of thing. But that's a very good point. All right. So these are the, again, we just a review of the four chilukei kapara. I want to share with you a thought about tshuva, which emerges from the Rambam, but it's also connected to yesterday's parsha. You know, yesterday's parsha has the largest number of mitzvahs in the whole Torah. It's amazing. 70 mitzvahs, a big proportion. But the first mitzvah is perhaps the most difficult to understand, and I'm not going to fully explain the difficulties there, and that is the Eisha Shefas Toar, the beautiful woman that is captured in war, and there's a protocol, even though she's a Goya, there's a protocol by which the person can stay with her if she undergoes certain things. First, I do want to point out that many Meforshim say that we are not dealing with rape. Now, that's the thing, because first of all, I think, gee, is the Torah... Good, the Torah is legitimating living with a Goya. That much is true. Is the Torah saying a man can just rape a woman? So again, many Meforshim say, maybe that makes it a little easier, that we're not dealing with rape, we're dealing with consensual. Now, it's still a big Avera, but it says in the time of war, it's hard to control the Yetzer, so God basically said, I'll give you a permissible way, because otherwise you'll do it be Avera. Now, it's a real big problem, and the Gemara itself says, if a person follows that path, there's going to be plenty of other problems, because right afterwards it talks about the man has two wives, one that he hates, and that's the Yefas Toar, and there'll be the rebellious Ben Soru Mora, and that's going to follow. And the truth of the matter is, David HaMelech's problems in the book of Shmuel is almost acting out these parshios, in which Avshalom and Amnon, all of these are children of Yefei Toar, and all sorts of tragic things happened to David HaMelech. And this is a difficult parsha, but I want to share with you a thought of the Or HaChaim in the name of the Zohar, who says that the parsha of Eisha Shefas Toar can be understood as well in an allegorical or metaphorical way. And he says, when the Pasuk says, Ki seitze lamelchama ala yevecha, when you go against your enemy to wage war, Unisano Hashem Elokecha biyadecha, v'shavisa shivyo, God will deliver that enemy into your hands, and you will capture your captive. So the Or HaChaim says, the greatest enemy we have in our life is our Yetzer Hara, and we have to wage war against our Yetzer Hara. We have to fight against the Yetzer Hara. So what does Hashem say? If you truly wage war against the Yetzer Hara, Unesanai Hashem Elokecha biyadecha, God will give you victory, vishavisa, and you will capture that which He's taken away from you. That's a great promise. Habal Tahir, as Chazal say, if you try to purify yourself, Misayinoso, Hashem will help you. That's Hashem's promise. If you wage the war, Hashem will give you that enemy. Now, so what is the Eisha Shefas Toar? The Or HaChaim continues with the allegory. The Eisha Shefas Toar is your neshama. Our neshama is described as a beautiful, radiant woman filled with light and kedusha. And you see this neshama captured, degraded, subjugated, unable to express its beauty. So you want to reclaim. I want to reclaim my neshama. So I bring her into the house, meaning I try to connect to it. The gilcha es rosha, shave her hair, shave her head. The yasasa siprana, which is machlokas, is it cut the fingernails or let them grow long? But the Or HaChaim is learning, let them grow long. So he explains that this is part of the process of tshuva, because part of what leads us astray are the crazy ideas we have in our head, false ideologies and philosophical ideas. So shave it off. In other words, take out the bad ideas that are in your mind. And the hands is what grasps the taivus of Eilam Hazeh, the wealth, the power, the sensualities. And by growing the fingernails, that symbolically means you grasp less. Right? When you have very long fingernails, you can't really grab things that well. So the gilcha es rosha, the yasasa es siporneha, is referring to both what we might call the cognitive process of tshuva, in which you try to reprogram your minds, and the behavioral aspects of tshuva, in which you try to become less of a person involved in acquisition of either power or things and the like. Now then it says, and she should cry for her father and her mother 30 days. So the Aruch Chaim says, father is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and mother is Klal Yisrael. That when I do tshuva, I realize that I haven't only hurt myself, but I've brought pain to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I've also betrayed the Jewish people. The Kol Yisrael are ravens, Elazar. Every Jew is responsible for the other Jew. So the harm that I perpetrate on myself hurts all of Klal Yisrael. Father and mother, I cry for my, or she cries, my neshama cries for father and mother. 30 days, the Aruch Chaim concludes, these are the 30 days of the month of Elul, which are the days of tshuva. Of course, the truth is Elul has only 29 days today, but okay. But because Rosh Hashanah is the 30th of Elul, is the first day of Rosh Hashanah. But this is the period of tshuva. So the Aruch Chaim, based on the Zohar, reads the whole parsha of Eisha Shefas Tohar as part of the process of tshuva and introspection that a person goes through, and then the pasuk says, "V'acharei kein." And when you've gone through that process, "Tavo eilaha ubialta," you become reunited with the goodness within yourself, and your neshama gets cleansed and reclaimed, and readmitted into its connection with you. Yes, I'm sorry.
Today is
9/11. Yes. I did remark on it. Yeah, it is something to think about. Of course, some people have raised the question whether we ought to remember the Hebrew date of 9/11. That's an interesting question. I mean, the English date is so better known, but like I have to go back and look. Oh, today's there's the Hebrew date as well. Yeah, no, I remember. Yeah. Some people, because of shlichas, they were saved. Yeah, that's right. The week before Rosh Hashanah. Right. Yes. No, that I remember. I don't remember the exact date. So it must be a little later then, because it was the week. Right, it was already. Yeah. But again, you know, when tragedies happen in the world, even if they, first of all, there were many Jews who died, but even tragedies that don't involve the Jewish people, and Kal Vachomer, tragedies that involve the Jewish people, these are all messages from HaKadosh Baruch Hu about thinking about the tshuva that we can do, thinking about the inhumanity of man against man, but also to look at things in a positive sense. One of the lessons of 9/11, again, just to go back a little bit, I don't want to get off my topic too much, but one lesson of 9/11, besides the negative power of the individual, is also a lesson in the fact that sometimes in tragedies, we discover the better part of ourselves, the selflessness, the devotion, the willingness to help, the willingness to be Moser Nefesh, that side by side with the greatest evil and darkness in the world, often comes the greatest light. Viktor Frankl, who lived in through the concentration camps, and he was not an observant Jew, unfortunately, but he never had the education, but he was a very spiritually sensitive and intuitive person, writes about the fact that many people that he knew before World War II, who were not particularly righteous, but in their confrontation with the evil of the Holocaust, became what he called moral saints. They would be, you know, they would risk their lives to give food or medicine to people who needed it. And that is the nature of things, that it sometimes takes the most difficult, darkest experiences to transform us into caring and loving people. Ideally, it should be without the need for that. But sometimes that's the situation. And the avodah of a person, as they go through life with all of its sufferings and all of its struggles, is to take those sufferings and struggles and use them as a vehicle for transformation and growth. The way Rav Soloveitchik put it, he said that the issue of, you know, why do bad things happen to good people, theodicy, that real, real difficult issue, the most difficult issue of all religion, should not be posed as a theological issue. It should be posed as a halachic issue. What does he mean? Theology asks the question, why does God do things? Theology, why does Hashem do things? That may be a question that is beyond our understanding. That is the ultimate lesson of the book of Iyov. According to the Gemara, that's what Hashem told Moshe when Moshe asked Hashem, show me your ways. And Hashem said, V'chanosi es asher racham. So to ask the question in theological terms, why did God do this or allow this to happen, might be asking an unanswerable question. But halacha asks, how do I respond to the situation that I'm facing? What is my responsibility in my matzav? That's a meaningful question, because a person can then say, how can I take this bitterness and turn it into something noble, turn it into something good? I think a lot about all of you know or know of Rabbi Seth and Sherry Mandel, who live in Tekoa, and a number of years ago they lost their son to a vicious terrorist, Kobe Mandel, who's a very good friend of my son, and I remember Kobe very well myself. And he was wandering around in the caves outside of Tekoa, and he was struck repeatedly on the head with sharp rocks till his brains oozed out. And it was just tragic. And one can imagine, or maybe one cannot imagine, I shouldn't even say one can imagine, one can barely imagine, not imagine at all, how devastating this was. I mean, this could break a person and destroy a person, take away their will to live and take away their ability to function. But what the Mandels did in particular was they took the pain of their loss and they used it as the basis for the comfort they bring, really, to hundreds, if not thousands, of other families who have lost family members to terrorism. They have summer camps and therapy programs and the like. And there is a concept in which you use your pain as a way of sensitizing you to the plights of others. And that becomes a positive force in the world. Is there an easier way that Hashem could have accomplished that? Well, that's already the theological question. But it is human nature that sometimes it is only the confrontation with the extreme evil that can bring out the extreme good. So in September 11, you need to also see the capacity of goodness that emerged. And of course, here in Eretz Yisrael, with Piguyim, and you know, we see this all the time as well. Of course, some of our wounds are self-inflicted, Gush Katif. some of them we do to ourselves. But even then, there are people who rise to the occasion to try to help and care about each other. Right, New Yorkers. New Yorkers are always known, again, maybe it's Lashon Hara, maybe it's not true, always known as cold, impersonal, you know, not caring, etc. Well, okay, but at least after September 11th, for a brief period of time, people came together and they were caring for each other and the like. Okay. But anyway, going back to this Eishes Shefas Toar. So we have the Orach Chaim's allegory. But here is the question I want to raise, because there seems to be a disconnect between the metaphor and the Pshuto Shel Mikra. Because in Halacha, there are two types of wars that can exist. There is what is called Milchemes Mitzvah. These are wars that you are commanded to wage. And these wars would be the war against Amalek, the war against the seven nations of Canaan, which don't exist today, and the third category, which is the only halachic war that Israel could fight today, and that is a defensive war, a war against enemies that try to destroy us. Those are the three categories of Milchemes Mitzvah. Now, there is another category, which we don't have today, and you'll see why, called Milchemes Rishus, which literally means optional wars of expansion. In other words, Israel decides to wage war against Cyprus. That way we can stop people from getting, you know, married in Cyprus, whatever the reason is. We want to conquer Cyprus. Now, you might think, That's crazy. You mean halacha allows just aggressive wars of expansion? Well, it does, but listen to the conditions.
Yeah.
Only if they're authorized by a Sanhedrin, which we don't have today, and more importantly even, only if permission is given by Hashem directly through the Urim V'Tumim, which is prophecy. So yeah, if Hashem gives you permission, go ahead and do it. Why would Hashem give permission? That's an interesting question, what the issue would be. But the basic idea is, there is no such thing as optional wars in the absence of prophetic authorization for those wars, which means today, obviously, it's impossible. There is no halakhic legit. I mean, Israel doesn't do it, but if Israel were to simply engage in some aggressive war of conquest, that would be against halacha, and anyone that they killed in that war, they would be guilty of murder. Now, Eishes Shefas Toar. Is Eishes Shefas Toar talking about Milchemes Mitzvah, or is it talking about Milchemes Rishus? Rashi says, Beferish, that the Pasuk has to be talking about Milchemes Rishus and not Milchemes Mitzvah, because since the Pasuk says you will capture captives, in a Milchemes Mitzvah like Amalek and the seven nations, there are no captives. You have to kill everybody. And if the Torah is talking about captives, it must be talking about Milchemes Rishus. Now, this is Pshuto Shel Mikra. So here's my question. My question is this. L'chaira, if we were to ask ourselves, is the war against the Yetzer Hara an optional war or an obligatory war, we would certainly call it the greatest Milchemes Mitzvah that we ever have in our lives. So how come the Torah is merames to the Milchemes HaYetzer in a parsha that is dealing with optional wars and not obligatory wars, since the Milchemes HaYetzer is certainly an obligatory war? In other words, there's a disconnect between the fact that the Pasuk is talking about Milchemes Rishus, and then you're bringing in the allegory of Milchemes HaYetzer. Yeah. Okay, I see. In other words, you're saying that the person has the choice. Yeah. Well, yeah, I understand that. But again, you know, when we say Bechira, Bechira means, it doesn't mean, let me put it this way. When we say I have the choice to keep Shabbos or not keep Shabbos, that doesn't mean God is saying you have the choice. In other words, you have the choice to rebel against Hashem, but you're still chayev to make the right decision. So here's the thought that is said in Sfarim. Very, very beautiful and interesting thought. And they say that although Yifas Toar is the Milchama of the Yetzer, and that's a great mitzvah, but the way you fight that Milchemes Mitzvah is the way you do a Milchemes Rishus. You don't fight the Milchemes HaYetzer like a Milchemes Mitzvah. You fight it like a Milchemes Rishus. What do I mean by that? In a Milchemes Mitzvah, the idea is to obliterate the enemy, to destroy the enemy. Hashem is merames that when we fight the Yetzer Hara, we don't destroy it, we capture it and sublimate it and transform it. Let's be practical. Often, when a person is a Baal Tshuva, of course we should all be Baal Tshuva, but when a person, let's say, comes from a background in which they were not keeping the mitzvahs of Hashem, there is often either internal or external pressure to kind of amputate their prior life. Don't be connected to their family relationships. Right? Sometimes people ask, oh, how can my children see my parents? You know, they don't keep kosher, whatever it is. I'll tell you this. The truth of the matter is that if we are concerned with negative influences that our children pick up, we ought to be much more concerned with bad midos than people who are mechalel Shabbos. Because the truth of the matter is, chilul Shabbos and violations of kashrus are not as contagious as bad midos. If a child is raised that on Shabbos you don't do certain things, and a child is raised you don't eat certain food unless it's certified, you'll see even a five-year-old. I mean, you've seen this over and over again. You've seen it yourself. Someone offers a five-year-old a candy, In fact, there are stories about Rav Moshe Feinstein offering kids candy, and the kid is saying, "Does this have the right hechsher?" or whatever. And you know, and the parent is like humiliated. And Rav Moshe says, "Gevaldik, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful." Right? So children understand. Children are very good at understanding rules, kind of mechanical rules. Don't eat anything unless you have, you know, the OU or the badat, whatever sign you're going to use. When it comes to midas, like anger, like lying, like selfishness, those are highly contagious conditions. If they're with people who behave that way, that's what kids do pick up. So the Emma says, when people say, how can I take them to my parents? You know, my parents, you know, whatever it is. I mean, assuming the right safeguards are there, that is not going to be a problem. But be it as it may, there's often a pressure to abandon the talents that a person had. A person was in music or art or whatever it is. It's not a yeshivish thing to do. Again, I'm speaking more from the male perspective, but I'm sure that I know there would be female analogs and the like. And we can call that the tshuva of amputation, where a person has so many years in which their life was not connected to God, and now they feel connected to Hashem. So you got to amputate. Now, sometimes amputation is necessary. Sometimes a relationship might be so toxic, might be so destructive, that you have to amputate. But that's a last resort. That's not a first resort. You see, and the same way that when you amputate an actual limb because it's gangrenous, there's still going to be phantom pain, which can be very devastating. So too, you can't really get rid of your life. Your life is going to come back to haunt you one way or the other. Or another analogy would be, if you ever try to delete something from a computer, it's always hanging around there somewhere. You've never really gotten rid of it. Right? So you can't really get rid of your 20, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And if you do get rid of it, what does that leave you? That leaves you with a zero. Because even if you get the clean slate, good, but what's a clean slate? All of my millions of averus are forgiven. Wonderful. But I got 40 years of nothing. But there's another mahalach of tshuva in which you don't destroy that evil in your past, but you take it and it becomes, you capture it, you conquer it, it becomes the foundation of the uniqueness of your relationship to Hashem. It gives you an aspect of avoda that you wouldn't have had you not gone through those experiences. A very simple example. If a person, let's say, was a drug addict, to take an extreme example, and the person now does tshuva. So one way of doing tshuva is, I'll never look at drugs, talk of drugs, I'll never know, which is Baruch Hashem, a wonderful thing, but that does mean that for 40 years it was an absolute zero. But what if a person takes those negative experiences and says, because I know what it's like, I'll be a counselor, I will help people. Then it turns out that the very thing that was bad now becomes the source of his goodness and his understanding. That is called not the tshuva of amputation. That is the tshuva of capturing the bad and making it good. The Torah's merames that by putting the Milchemes Hayetzer in a parsha dealing with Milchemes Rishus, it is teaching you a profound lesson that the optimal way of tshuva is not by destroying your identity, but it is by taking your identity and using it as the source of your strength. In fact, this is a meaning of a Gemara that says, when you do tshuva out of love, your averos become mitzvahs. How can averos become mitzvahs? They become mitzvahs when they are the foundation of the uniqueness of my relationship to Hashem. You know, sometimes, Baruch Hashem in Yerushalayim, we look at families, you walk through Mei Hasharim or whatever it is, and you see somebody who came, you know, just make a, from 100 generations of Rabbanim and Gedolim. Of course, none of that is a guarantee. I mean, I think Karl Marx came from 36 generations of rabbis. But okay, but there's no guarantee. But be it as it may, you say to yourself, who am I? I come from North Dakota or whatever it is. And, you know, I don't know anything. I don't have minhagim. I don't have mesorah. In other words, I learn things from books and shiurim. But the truth is, you have to know that the same way
that the person in Meir Sharim who comes from 36 generations of Rabbanim has many things that we don't have, and that's true, and many gifts. The person who comes from North Dakota has gifts that the other person doesn't have either. Hashem put our neshamas where our neshamas were. Hashem put us through those journeys, through those experiences. And to simply say now, my job is to make believe they never existed, is the same thing as cutting off your arm, which there are times you have to do it. But that's not the optimal way. The optimal way is taking that arm and making it strong. And taking the uniqueness of your experiences, the uniqueness of the struggles that you've had in life, to create that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The tshuva of transformation instead of the tshuva of amputation. And that is why the paradigm of tshuva is that of the Milchemes Rishus and not the Milchemes Mitzvah, because the Milchemes Mitzvah obliterates the enemy. The Milchemes Rishus conquers the enemy. And this is a big issue. You know, this is an issue in many, many areas of life. It's an issue of how we relate to our family. I'll tell you a story. I remember years ago, I knew a man, he lives in Yerushalayim here, he grew up in Falls Church, Virginia, in a totally secular environment. And he came to Eretz Yisrael. Not only did he become Shomer Shabbos, but he actually became a Gerer Chassid. Oh. Strangely enough, it's hard to know because you don't pick it up in Eishet Torah or Ar Sameach. But he became a Gerer Chassid with a spudik and knee socks. And lo and behold, he got engaged to a woman who was similarly situated. Uh-huh. Strange situation. So they were getting married in Meir Shorim. And not only was there a mechitza, but the chassan and the kala, the women were in two different buildings. The women were like a block and a half away or something, as it were. And, you know, I had black hat, black suit, but I felt uncomfortable. It wasn't my normal situation. But I remember his parents were there. And if I felt a little out of place, his parents felt it was like the Twilight Zone, you know. They had no idea what they were walking into. This was like a, you know. So it went on and on. At the end, for Shever Brachas, which was delayed a little bit because they had to bring the kala from two blocks away, but for Shever Brachas, they bring the kala back into the room for benching. So the chassan gave a drasha before Shever Brachas, in which he spoke in Yiddish. It's interesting enough, somehow he picked up Yiddish. But then, no, Shever didn't know Yiddish at all. But then at the end, he spoke some words in English to his parents, and he said, Mom and Dad, I know that you think I'm totally different than the child that you raised, but I want you to know that 90% of what I am is from you, and the 10% that is not is because you gave me the strength to become my own person. And I still remember, it was so cute. I remember there was a Meir Sharim guy who didn't understand a word, but he was like nodding. He got a sense this was something meaningful, so he was nodding, you know, nodding away in affirmation. and the like, Dvarim Hayetzim in Alev, Nechnasim in Alev. But this is such a beautiful idea because it basically does not use Yiddishkeit as a way of breaking down, of building up walls and cutting people off. But the notion that that past is what made me. That past in Falls Church is a foundation of why I serve Hashem in the way I serve Hashem. And all of that is the tshuva of recapturing. And that's a very, very profound idea because there is tremendous pressure to conform in a religious society, and some of it is, to some degree, is justified. Obviously, we don't want every single avant-garde thing that somebody was doing. Some things are a violation of halakha, right? If somebody was a nudist or whatever it is, you know, we're not going to say, do your own thing, you know. Obviously, there are gevulim, for sure, for sure. But sometimes there is a pressure to kind of sap out the individuality and uniqueness that a person has. And that's not the Ratzon Hashem. The Ratzon Hashem is not to take that away. You know, things like, you know, I really don't know if these are legends or not because I don't have any daughters in seminary. But they tell me that on applications, they ask you if you have a white tablecloth Friday night or an off-white tablecloth. Is it vegetable soup or chicken soup? Apparently, these are it's hard for me to believe that is true, but I don't know. But apparently, these are things that are considered to be negative factors, you know, if you deviate from a certain norm. But the truth of the matter is, you know, a person is supposed to be an individual too, that within the tzibur of Klal Yisrael, the beauty of Klal Yisrael comes from the diversity. The Medrash gives a mashal about a melech who loved a certain type of flower.
So somebody decided to plant gardens and gardens of the same flower. The Melech didn't like it anymore.
No.
The Melech loved the flower against the backdrop of everything else. And whenever everyone tries to be exactly the same, that is not so merutza in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants the beauty of each personality to emerge. So this is why, this is the important reason why the tshuva is the Milchemes Rishus of capturing and not the Milchemes Mitzvos. Have a good day.